Hey, thanks, Lars. Yeah, so it's great to be back again here in Santa Barbara. And I'd like to take the opportunity today to tell you a little bit about three things that are keeping us excited in the world of ultra-cold atoms and are very related to the program. And of course, you know, hearing about the Nobel Prizes last week, they're actually also very connected to this year's Nobel Prizes. You read the justification carefully, you actually also see there's actually a lot of connections to cold atom research over the past years. So let me start and begin with how we can probe topological matter with ultra-cold atoms. And I want to tell a little bit about recent advances in our quantum gas microscopes towards, you know, exploring maybe things that are relevant in the context of the Fermi-Hubbard model and high TC. And finally, a completely new topic that got me very excited over the past years, which is this topic about many-body localization, which really touches upon many of the foundations of statistical physics, and actually when statistical physics does not work anymore. Okay, so let me start with topic one on topological matter. And if we think about topological matter, well, systems that come to our minds are, for example, the integer quantum Hall effect, fractional quantum Hall effect, complicated topological insulators, etc. And if we just focus on the integer quantum Hall effect for a second, we typically think of a system, a 2D electron gas, you know, slab of material here, 2D electron gas, we expose it to a magnetic field, and we find these quantized Hall conductance plateaus, which are very robust to impurities that the system can have and deformations. And the question is, of course, why? You know, why is it such a robust phenomena, for example, this integer quantum Hall effect? And the answer was given by this year's Nobel Prize winners, Thouless, for example, who kind of, for the first time, wrote down the intimate connection between topology, geometric effects, and quantum mechanics, and the robustness of the integer quantum Hall effect. So how let me just remind you again, in the more modern language of Berry phases, how this comes about, and then I'll tell you how we can measure this in a completely new light, maybe with cold atoms. So imagine you have a Hamiltonian, which depends on some parameter set R, and we evolve adiabatically Hamiltonian through a cyclic path of these parameters, then our wave function will have a dynamical phase, which is, you know, just the E times T divided by H bar factor, plus we know it will also pick up a some cases also this geometric phase as we go around a closed loop in parameter space. And this is really important. So this is this abstract R space. It doesn't have to be real space. It can be any set of parameters that this Hamiltonian depends on. We start here, we change the parameters, and we come back to the original point, okay, that we have here. Now we can also write this Berry phase in the following way. We'll actually make it clear how we can measure these things in the end. This is an integral over a closed contour. This is our contour C, our line integral C, over something like a vector potential, which is actually called the Berry connection of the system along this closed contour. Or if we invoke Stokes' theorem, actually we can write this as, just using this kind of free space notation, as the curl of this kind of vector potential, this Berry connection, over the area involved. Okay, so this is what we call the Berry curvature coming in, and this is what we call the Berry connection. And this Berry connection is actually defined through the eigenstates of your system, so in this adiabatic quantum state evolution, where this kn, these parameters are, that's eigenstates, which depends on these parameters R. Take the gradient with respect to R of this eigenstate and overlap it again with the original eigenstate. This defines this so-called Berry connection. And then the Berry curvature, we said omega n, just if I use the simplified R3 description, is just the curl of that. And of course, you can generalize that to any kind of dimension that you have in mind. Okay. Okay, so now this, as we said, the important point is that this Berry phase, this geometric phase that we pick up, is basically the line integral over the Berry connection along this closed contour path, or if we use Stokes' theorem, the integral over the Berry curvature over the area of this kind of loop we're carrying out in the system. Okay, and the way I'm writing it is actually very analogous to the Aronoff-Bohm phase shift for a charged particle in a metallic field. But remember, this is kind of more abstract. This is the geometric phase interpretation, but kind of we'll make not many connections to this between the two, actually. Okay, so what we want to study here in the talk I give here is Bloch bands. So we're dealing with particles on lattices. And so we write the Bloch state wave functions as plane waves times the self-periodic part. And now if we have a certain Brillouin zone of the system, we could also change, for example, the momentum of the particle. This is kx and ky, the momentum components of our Bloch waves. These are now the parameters that we can change. So we can have a Hamiltonian which depends in momentum space on these parameters k. This is our lattice Hamiltonian. And if we move a particle through this Brillouin zone along a closed contour path, remember the parameters are now the k parameters of momenta, then the phase shift I'll pick up will be the dynamical phase plus the phase that depends on the very curvature enclosed in this path here. Now there's a very special contour you can take in a Brillouin zone, and that's just moving around the edge of the Brillouin zone. So I could just go take the particle around the edge of this Brillouin zone, like so. And that would correspond to, if I use Stokes' theorem, basically carrying out an integral over the very curvature over the entire Brillouin zone of your system. The Brillouin zone. Now comes the important work, the 1982 work of Thouless, where he basically noted that this number always has to be an integer and connects bulk to boundary properties of the system. So this is an integer, this line integral ak dk around the boundaries of our Brillouin zone here, around this path C, that's the same as 1 over 2 pi over the very curvature of the system, over the area of the Brillouin zone. So it's important to do this over the full Brillouin zone of your system. And this number has to be an integer. It's basically a generalized Gauss-Bonnet theorem that you might know from kind of this normal geometry. You integrate the curvature over a sphere, different Euler characteristics. And this is kind of the generalization of this Euler characteristic of this number that we have, and can only be 0, plus minus 1, and so forth. So it has to be an integer. So this term number has to be an integer. All right, and now there's, of course, this famous bulk-edge correspondence, which connects the properties of the bulks. You see, here we're just talking about bulk properties. We're talking about a very curvature which lives in the band structure of the system. It doesn't have to have any edge. It gives us this integer number. And this integer number actually was connected by Thouless to the Hall connectivity, basically telling us that this Chern number tells us how many edge channels there are on the boundary of the system. And each of those edge channels is characterized by a quantized conductance of E squared over H, and if you have n Chern number edge channels, then the total kind of bulk conductivity will be quantized. And this is what we call the bulk edge correspondence, and that's the famous 1982 work, which cited in the Nobel's citation this year. Okay, so by now what you should have kept in mind if we talk about band structures, we basically talk about two things. So we have the dispersion relation, the scalar property, okay, so that everybody knows. It links the momentum and the energy of the particles. But we also have these geometric properties of the bands, okay? So we have this very connection, this very curvature in the bands that also determine important properties like, for example, this quantum distortion. Okay, this we know how to measure. The question is, how can we measure this? And I want to show you two new methods how we can do that. First one is actually semi-classical transport, and actually will show us that many of these ideas actually are not so young. Actually, they were known already in the 50s, but kind of forgotten again. So let me try to tell you how we measure this and tell you how we measure this churn number without making use of edge states in the system. Okay. So let me write down the Simic classical transport equations for a wave packet in a band structure. Okay. So we have a wave packet which is formed around some momenta kc. And the force acting on this wave packet, that will simply be the electric field acting on the particle. That's the first term. Plus we have the Lorentz force term, of course. We have CdT cross the B field at the position of the wave packet. And then the velocity with which our wave packet will be moving in the lattice, well, that's just given by the group velocity. So that's just 1 over h bar gradient of k of our dispersion relation. Minus this term here, vkc dt cross omega kc times z. Okay, and this is what we call the Anomalous Hall velocity. And it's interesting to note that this term was introduced already in the 50s by Kaplus and Luttinger, but was kind of forgotten in the semi-classical transport dynamics. So if you open Ashcroft and Merman textbooks, standard solid state textbooks, this term is not there. Although you see by looking at the symmetry of the equations, it has to be there. It makes total sense that this term is there, just by thinking about the symmetry of these equations. But it was kind of forgotten. It was actually rediscovered. So let me just give credit to these people. So this was Kaplus and Luttinger in 54 already, who noted this term. And then it was recovered in a more modern kind of description by Sundaram and New in 1999, you know, when we talk about modern kind of description of these geometrical effects. OK, so now what we're going to consider is a model which has some Berry curvature in the band structure. And one model we can think of is, for example, the famous Hofstadter model. So we take this square lattice in which the particles are moving. And each plaquette here is exposed to some flux, phi, meaning that if a particle moves around the closed loop here, it will pick up a phase shift corresponding to this magnetic flux. That's the characteristics. That's the Hofstadter model. So we just want to apply this to. It has a pretty spread out Berry curvature over the bands. And let me now just give you, tell you how we can actually, how using this semi-classical transport theory and these simple bands that we have here, how we can derive the quantized deflection that we experience due to this Berry curvature in the bands. Okay, what it actually means to have quantized transport if we have no edges in the system. We're going to see this is what we're going to apply to our kind of atom clouds in the end. Okay, so the experiment we want to do is we want to take our atom clouds in the traps. We want to expose them to this kind of topological band structure. We're going to apply a force in the y direction, which is exactly this term here. Remember, this is just a force acting on the particle. This is something that lives in the band structure. And we're going to get a drift velocity which is orthogonal to the force we apply. This is just the Anomalous Hall velocity. Remember, I'm not applying any magnetic field here. I'm just talking, we're actually doing this without a magnetic field. So this is something that is just a characteristic of this band structure. Now you ask, and we're going to see action derivation, what is the average x velocity I pick up? Okay, what's the expectation value of that? Well, let's say we have a total number of particles, in our case atoms, in our system. Well, then it will be just the Anomalous Hall velocity at k space point k. Remember, this Anomalous Hall velocity depends on where you are in momentum space. So this is the Anomalous Hall velocity at momentum k. And then I just have to weight it with how many particles I actually have at point at momentum k. Okay, it's just the weighted average of this Anomalous Hall velocity. And then I just have to carry out k integral over the momentum space. Okay, now comes the point where it's important to see when can you expect something quantized. You can expect something quantized when you can pull out this thing in front of the integral. When can you do that? When you have a homogeneous filling of your browser. When the number of particles per k space point is constant, does not depend on k. Okay? That could be the case if you have a filled band, all the states in the band are filled, then this is a constant. But it doesn't necessarily have to be. This just has to be something that's not k-dependent anymore. But so let's imagine the case where this is just a constant now, where I've filled my band actually equally over all kind of states. So this is just a constant. What is it? I'll just put this 2 pi factor in. That's just the number of atoms divided by the size of my Brillouin zone. Okay, if it's a square Brillouin zone, then the size will be just the product of this delta kx here and delta ky. And since I'm assuming homogeneous filling, then it's just the number of particles divided by the area of the Brillouin zone. Now, this has become independent of k, so I can pull it in front of the integral. Here I have the force, the constant force acting on the particle, divided by h bar, 1 over 2 pi. I'm just canceling out those 2 pi's, but it will make sense in a second. And now you get this omega of k into k. Okay, and now you see, now you get this integral over the Berry curvature over the entire Brillouin zone of the system. And now this is where the Chern number appears for the first time. Remember, this was this integer number that we had. So this is the Chern number. This is the integer that we have here. And now we can rewrite this. We can think about the Inder-Hofstadter model. If I have a flux, which is just a rational of 2 pi, rational number of 2 pi, then the area of this Brillouin zone will be simply given by 2 pi over A and 2 pi over QA. And so basically what I get in the end is minus 2 pi squared, 1 over 2 pi over A and 2 pi over QA. So this is just for a rational flux of P over Q. This is just the size of the Brillouin zone I have in the Hofstadter model, Fy divided by H bar times this Chern number. And now you can see that we can rewrite this as minus FYA divided by H bar QA times the Chern number. And now we're done with the derivation. So because what you see, what's going to happen now, this QA times the Chern number, this number here, that's just 1 over the Bloch period. So remember, when you apply a force to a particle in a lattice, it actually oscillates back and forth with a period given by exactly h over h bar divided by FYA. H over the force times the lattice distance. So this is just the oscillation period of the particle in the vertical direction by normal Bloch oscillations. And so you see now what this quantization condition is going to mean. It's going to mean that our average Hall velocity is going to be just q times a lattice constant deflection times the Chern number per Bloch period. Okay, so if I'm a particle, if I'm now in this lattice, per Bloch period, I'm going to displace q lattice sides to the right while applying a force forward. Okay, and that's the quantization I get in this bulk transport without any edge states.
What happened to p?
It doesn't matter. It doesn't play a role here, the P. So it's just the number of bands you have, the size of the Brillouin zone is independent of P. Because it has to be, you know, you have to, basically what the unit cell is enlarged by a factor of Q only, because all the Qs have to sum up, the fluxes have to sum up to 2 pi, and the P just gives you P times 2 pi. So it doesn't matter. Okay. So the Brillouin zone is enlarged by a factor of Q only. Okay, so this is what we have. That's the quantized deflection we have, and that's precisely what we measured. So we did exactly that experiment. We placed these atom clouds in these lattices, applied, basically filled them, filled the lattice homogeneously, so we had this constant. And then we looked at the transverse deflection of our cloud, and we could see that per long period, we could see like QA lattice sites, and this allowed us to measure the Chern number without measuring kind of edge states, and came out to be 0.99. Where it's supposed to be 1 from theory. Okay, so this just shows you how you can get this quantized transport by just these simple semi-classical equations of motion, which were already derived in the 50s, but again, kind of forgotten. Okay, let me give you a second, a slightly more elegant example, I think.
Well, can you just give us a few details on what you actually measured, how you prepared it? Fermions, what do you...
So this was actually done with bosons.
Okay.
We just had to localize them. Okay. Because you remember when you localize a boson to a Vanier site, It's a superposition of all the block waves, a homogeneous superposition of all the block waves. So we could even do this with bosons.
Okay.
So that you don't have to have a Fermi C. Fermi C can do it, but something else can do it also. So we did thermal bosons, okay, localized to the band, and then we looked at the in-trap deflection of the atom cloud. Okay, so and we could reverse the flux. We could go to phi, minus phi, do some checks, do a system without flux. Then we see no deflection, transverse deflection of the cloud. And from these deflection profiles, how many steps, how many lattice sites, you know, the cloud deflects per block cycle, we could measure this Chern number. That's how we did it.
So the band structure with the Berry curvature was engineered because you used flux.
Yeah, I didn't tell you how we engineered that. That would be another talk, to tell you how we actually engineered these Hofstadter bands. I didn't tell you that. I just told you how we measure it. If we have the Hofstadter band,
because but it was something where we don't have. Way to measure, if you didn't have it to start with, you would have gotten a null result.
You would have gotten a null result. Yeah, we checked that, of course. When we have a system without flux, then we have a null result. Just for those, it's a good point just to bring it up. I mean, remember, we're dealing with neutral atoms, so we can't make just, you know, the what the condensed matter physicists do, we can't just apply a B field and get something topological because the charlicles are neutral. There's no Lorentz force, so we have to do a little bit more work to do this. But in the essence, well, the only thing that matters to mimic a magnetic field is that once the particle hops around the loop, it has to pick up a phase shift. Remember, that's Aronoff-Bohm phase shift. If we can mimic something like that, we have mimicked essentially the effect of a B field on an electron in a solid. But I didn't tell you how we do that. Yeah. I don't want to tell you today, but I can tell you, of course.
What are P and Q?
P and Q, these are just integer numbers, actually. It was quarter flux, actually. But we can do anything. That's a nice thing. That's also something we should stress. We can do anything from 0 to pi or 2 pi. And that would correspond to, I mean, thousands of Tesla magnetic field in a real solid. Okay, so usually you can only realize very low fluxes here unless you use super lattice structures in solids. To have kind of phase shifts are very low usually. In our case, we can have anything from 0 to 2 pi. In our case, actually, we use pi over 2, so quarter flux case.
And you can calculate the Chern number as well?
Yeah, of course. Chern number would be 1, and we measure at 0.19. Yeah, this is just single particle physics. Everything I'm telling you, I think the important message here, because you see, we can move a single particle around the boundary of the Brillouin zone. This will give us the same as filling up with a Fermi C in the band. This is what Klaus von Witzing does, the solid state physicist will do. He takes an insulator, fills with the Fermi C, integrates the Berry curvature through the Fermi C. But likewise, we can take an electron, we can take an atom, move it around, a single atom, move it around the boundaries of the Brillouin zone, we will get the same number. Okay. And that's actually what I want to show you next, a kind of slightly.
Can you realize higher Chern number?
Yeah, you can also realize higher Chern numbers depending on the fluxes you have, which where you are in the band.
But do you need like one boson per site?
You need to have localized boson.
Yeah.
It could actually have holes. It would be completely fine. Because you see, if you just think of we have a lattice, and we think of a localized wave packet, this expands homogeneously into all block waves, the bounding function. So there can be holes. It doesn't matter. It doesn't have to be a Fermi C. Fermi C is also good. It doesn't have to be. All right. Okay, so let me show you the second method. I'm going too slow, but it doesn't matter. Don't make it through everything. But yeah, please ask questions. Okay, so let me actually remove the semi-classical transport because I want to add another way of measuring these geometric properties, which is like really something new, but very much makes use of this thing, the analogy between this and this. And it's a very nice connection to the Aronoff-Bohm effect that we learned already about. Talked about so much. Okay. So let me remind you first of the Aronoff-Bohm effect, and then show you how we can measure, how we can build such an interferometer, precisely the same interferometer in momentum space for the particles. Sorry. And I call this our Aronoff-Bohm type interferometer to measure now very fast. So let me remind you again. You know, we have an electron. We have a region with a magnetic field here with some flux enclosed. And what we typically do, we split the electron wave function, move it around this region of flux, interfere the electron wave packet again to read out kind of the Aronoff-Bohm phase shift. What is this Aronoff-Bohm phase shift? This, of course, happens in real space. So this is x and y. The Aronoff-Bohm phase shift is just simply q over h bar integral over the vector potential of your electromagnetic field along this closed loop here that you find here. And that, again, if we use Stokes' theorem, is nothing but q divided by h bar integral b dA over the area of the interferometer. And that is, of course, the flux, magnetic flux enclosed. So this is just 2 pi phi divided by phi 0, where h over q is the flux quantum. Now, I can rewrite exactly the same equations with everything you know now from this side. We can rewrite it in precisely the same way. We can build such an interferometer now in momentum space of a solid. This is now momentum kx. This is momentum ky. Then we have some region here with E field. Here there's some region with Berry flux. Okay. And now if I move a particle in momentum space around this region, I will also pick up a phase shift. In total analogy to the Aronoff-Bohm phase shift, I can, in fact, write the equations for this Berry phase in precisely the same way. This is just the Berry curvature in momentum space integrated over the area here of my interferometer gives me kind of the enclosed Berry flux, and the Berry phase depends on that. Okay. And this is what we did in the second experiment. We kind of took atoms in momentum space, split their wave packet, moved the atoms in momentum space now along such trajectories as this one here, and interfered them again. Okay, and that allowed us to measure the Berry flux in these systems. Okay, so this is really a purely interferometric method, and we applied it actually to a system where the transport method would totally fail. And that's, of course, a nice example that I would like to highlight. Graphene, another Nobel Prize. Graphene, I remind you again, has this very interesting Brillouin zone in momentum space. So you have the center of the Brillouin zone, the gamma point. You have these k and k prime points here where you have this relativistic dispersion relation. This is why people talk about the relativistic electron, the graphene, precisely located here. That's just in the dispersion relation. You have this linear dispersion relation. You have the relativistic electrons. But remember, there's also the geometric effects, okay? And the geometric effects, actually, in graphene are such that at these Dirac points, you have pi Berry flux localized as a Dirac delta function. So there's a singularity in this geometric property. So you have pi Berry flux minus pi Berry flux, pi Berry flux minus pi, but really in a singular delta function. Okay, now any finite system will not have a singular delta function, so it will be a little bit spread out, but highly concentrated at least at these points. And this also shows you that's not something you can measure with transport, because if you would move your atom cloud like we did before, in the filled Brillouin zone through this region, this has zero measure. Okay, so you can't really probe it. But by moving an atom around it in this interferometric way, you can probe this singularity and measure the phase shift. Okay, so what I'm plotting now is our data points. I'll try to do them justice. So we're building such an interferometer here with this area here, and I'm changing the endpoint of the interferometer loop. I'm starting at, so this is k final of the interferometer, and this is the phase shift we measured. And you start at zero, and it stays zero until you hit the k point, the Dirac cone. As soon as you enclose the Dirac cone, it jumps to pi. Then continues, and up here there's another Dirac cone, k prime, and when you hit that one, it jumps back to zero again. You can see here. Okay, so this is pi phase shift. And this step for us was extremely sharp that we measured. We only had to change the final momentum here by 1%, and we would suddenly have this phase shift from zero to pi. And that actually means that this Berry flux has to be highly localized. Actually, we could tell that omega, the Berry flux, is localized to about 10 to minus 6 of the Brillouin zone area in our system, okay, from that data. Okay, basically, you can have any loop you want. You know, with this interferometric technique, if you would have Berry curvature distributed in a very strange way in your Brillouin zone, you could just have to, move your particles around this very strange loop, and then you could measure the distribution of Berry curvature in the system. So finally, as the last thing, I want to tell you just brief extensions to the band, to the case where you have multiple bands.
Can you mention a little more how you move it?
Are you moving? Okay. Okay, so let's go back. Let's go to the ground zone. Okay, we start here. Okay. Then we bring the atoms in a superposition of a spin up state and a spin down state. So now the atom is in a coherent superposition of two spin states. Then we have a magnetic field gradient acting in the horizontal direction, which moves the spin up particle to the left and the spin down particle to the right. Okay, but it's just one atom. It's just in a coherent superposition. Simultaneously, we add a spin independent force in the vertical direction. Okay, so you see both move up, but in opposite directions. So they move along these paths here. Once they're here, we apply a pi pulse, so spin up flips into spin down. So the magnetic moments are reversed, so the horizontal forces are reversed. So now they move like this. How we apply the spin independent force, that's, I have to tell you a little bit how we realize these graphene lattices. To realize the graphene lattices, we just have to interfere three laser beams. And those of you who remember my public talk at KITP, I showed you the nice images of Ted Hench, where he just interfered three beams, and you get this beautiful hexagonal laser light, laser pattern. Now, if you have all frequencies the same, then you have a static hexagonal lattice. However, if you detune the frequencies slightly, so this is omega plus a small offset, then you can turn this into a walking wave, moving lattice. If you change the frequency over time, then you have an accelerating lattice. And in the frame of the atoms, it looks like a force. And now, by just programming the difference frequency of those three beams, we can basically accelerate the lattice in any direction. So we can basically have a force acting in any direction we want. So I can trace out any contour you want in the Brillouin zone. So that's how we do it in practice. Is it clear? Okay.
Well, measure the phase shift. How do you do that?
So basically, it's just Ramsey interferometer. Remember when you have a pi over 2 pulse? Pi over 2 pulse here. Don't we interfere them? And then we scan the phase of the final pi over 2 pulse, and then we read out the Ramsey fringe. That's our interference signal. And we measure the phase shift of that signal relative to a reference interferometer phase. That's how we do it. All right, let me just then briefly finally state this extension to multiple bands, because this makes connection to another nice concept of Wilson lines. So when you have multiple bands, makes sense to talk about the geometry of these quantum systems in terms of Wilson lines. So how does that work? Let me just remind you again. So far, we've been talking about, there have been some energy states where, as we vary parameters, this is our parameters, but we vary, could be k-space. So far, what I discussed was the case when we move adiabatically through one of the bands, and what we pick up then is the Berry phase. Okay. Now, imagine these, you have degenerate bands. Now, you have two bands which are degenerate. Then you can not only pick up a phase, but basically you have to describe this as a rotation matrix W within this degenerate subspace. Okay? So it's the extension of the Berry phase to multiple degenerate bands, the description by Vilcek and Z, and you basically describe, you go from here now not only to one band, but you can go into two bands, and this is described by this Wilson line operator. And this Wilson line operator is just path ordered kind of generalization of what we've written down so far. So we have again the closed contour over now the Berry connection. But now this Berry connection also has to include the multiple degenerate bands that we're discussing, EQ, that describes basically this multi-band situation in our lattices. And now this Berry connection also has kind of off-diagonal components and can also be non-abelian in certain situations, where this is now kind of a generalized form of what I wrote down before, where this could be now the Berry connection between different bands and an N prime, which are these degenerate bands. Okay. And this is what we also measured in the experiment and could show that's a very useful concept to characterize the quantum geometry of such situations where you have several bands in your system and you want to characterize the whole quantum geometry through these Wilson line operators, gives you a full characterization of the geometric effects of these bands. And we also did that in the graphene case. In the graphene case, for the experts of you, you think, where are the degenerate bands? The two S bands are not degenerate a priori, but it turns out when you are in a so-called strong force limit, when you apply a force that basically you can't resolve the energy difference between those S bands, you basically approach these limits as if they would be degenerate. Okay, just enough kind of to tell you about that. All right, that's everything I wanted to tell you about probing topological geometric effects. If you have no questions or the questions on this part, because I would just erase everything I have.
Yeah. We have also experiments on the multiple bands already?
Yeah, we measured that for the case of the two S bands, which is a simple case, but there we kind of measured this 2x2 Wilson matrix, okay, the eigenvalues of that, which characterize the geometry of the system. Any more questions, comments? Okay, so now I hope for those of you who haven't been exposed to Thouless ideas yet, that they became maybe a little bit clearer. So let me move on to topic two, to some news on our quantum gas microscope experiments, which are really, you know, whole new ways of probing many body systems. And let me just give you a brief status update of what's happening there. And actually also connects to now different topological order, the one that was introduced by Haldane, the string order. And I'll show you how we can actually measure that with these quantum gas microscopes. Okay, so let me switch topics two and talk about the quantum gas microscopes. And let me just remind you again what it means if you can take single snapshots of a many-body quantum system. So imagine you have a ground state of your complex many-body system. And this could be, in our case, in our lattice, it could be kind of a superposition of different configurations of those particles on the lattice. Would be different occupations. And now if you take a snapshot of such a system, just writing it down in its full glory, if you take a photo of such a many-body system, what's going to happen? You know, if you do that with single lattice site resolution and single atom sensitivity, well, basically the wave function is going to collapse onto one of those superposition states. Which one, you don't know a priori. So it's just going to collapse onto one. Let's say it collapses onto this one. Okay, so you measure as a photograph, you see this particle configuration that you have here. Now you could repeat the experiment, you could prepare psi again, measure again, and then it might collapse onto this one, you don't know. Okay? So essentially what you get by this is this probability that a certain configuration occurs. But that's extremely powerful because it means through these probabilities you can measure kind of all kind of non-local correlation functions. For example, you could ask questions of how is the density on site K correlated with the density on site L, with the density on site M, with the density on site N. Okay. It's a 4-point correlation function. Okay, that's something you just cannot measure in a normal condensed matter experiment. You might ask, okay, well, but there are also these phase factors here that could be important too. That's true, and we can't measure them directly, but what we can measure is something current. We can measure currents on between bonds on the lattice. So we can also measure things like something like this, okay? So the current operator, and we can measure also non-local current correlations. Okay, so things like that, that's what we can measure. And that's extremely powerful. It gives you completely new access to the many-body states, to characterizing many-body states on the lattice. And it's not only that we can measure the average values of those, we can measure the full distribution functions. Okay. Now, why is that useful? Okay. Well, it's useful because it's precisely correlators of this nature which are important to characterize, for example, hidden topological order. And for those of you who've never heard of this, let me just briefly remind you how we define normal order according to the classical Landau paradigm of phase transitions. Order parameter, according to this Landau paradigm, we typically talk about something which has long-range correlations, for example, as we take the points x and y to infinity, we look at some correlation functions of some observable A, and look at the correlation between points x and y. This assumes some constant value. Right? This is this idea of long-range order. And there are no simple examples of that are, of course, magnets, ferromagnetic magnets, antiferromagnetic systems, and so forth. A condensate, just a standard condensate with a wave function, falls into the same class that we characterize by macroscopic wave function. But all of those are, in a sense, local order parameters, because if you tell me what's happening at point X, I can tell you what's happening at point Y at any distance. Okay, so the local knowledge is sufficient to predict what's happening anywhere else in the system. That's what we call these local order parameters. However, we know, not only now by the work of Haldane, but by many others, that there are other kind of ideas, other types of order, that can characterize many-body systems, which are hidden, and I'll tell you in a sense why people consider them as hidden. So imagine you again want to correlate the value at two points, x and y, okay, and this assumes a constant value, but it only assumes a constant value if you know everything else that's going on between those points, x and y, along a string connecting those two points, x and y. So these are two points, x and y. This is some other observable b. And you have to know that this assumes a correlator, assumes a finite constant value. For this, you have to know what's going on between those two endpoints on all the points in between. And that's why people typically call this hidden order, because that's not accessible to any experiment. You can't just take a solid, you know, you measure a point x and point y, because you don't know what's going on in between. But with the quantum microscope experiments, we have access to such non-local order parameters. And a simple one we measured in the case of the superfluid to Mott transition. And so what you need is this global view on the quantum state that you get with the quantum gas microscopes. OK, I'll skip maybe the example of the Haldane spin 1 chain. Or maybe I'll just write it down for you. So, for example, this hidden antiferromagnet has a hidden topological order in the so-called spin 1 chain. So you have spin bonds with long-range interactions in the system, and the ground state shown by Haldane to have this topological order, and we can think of the ground state of this spin 1 chain to be of the following order. It's a superposition of configurations of the following sort. You have a spin up particle that would be plus 1 spin, and you have maybe spin 0, then you have a spin down, then you have a spin up, you have a hole, a spin down, up, hole. Okay, so what characterizes, and you have a superposition of all those states, well, you don't know how many zeros, bless you, how many zeros are between the plus and minuses. Okay, just, that's what I write down in the superposition. So if you look at this state closer, what you see, it's actually a hidden antiferromagnet. If I would remove all the zeros, you had up, down, up, down, up, down. But since you don't know a priori, you know, how many zeros are in between, if you would just measure a two-point correlator, it would give you zero result. So you have to know what's going on in between on this line. And this is something you can measure with the string order parameter. And this hidden antiferromagnet also has fractional spins on the edge. So the spin fractionalizes from a spin 1 into 2 spin 1 halves. And actually, that's something I want to explain to you, how we think we can measure something like this spin fractionalization, charge fractionalization, with the quantum gas microscope experiments. An experiment that has not been done yet, but I hope it will be done soon in the future. But it just gives you a nice idea, and I think it takes, for me, it took a lot of the mysticism out of fractional charges, at least. So let me explain them to you. And actually, I have strong connections to Santa Barbara. So this is the celebrated Sushli-Fahegar model that Heger developed here to explain conductive polymers. And I just want to show you how very simple fractional charges arise in the Sushli-Fahegar model and what it actually means to measure them in an experiment. Okay. So let me give you an example of how to measure fractional charges. And the idea applies to anywhere where you have fractional charges in condensed matter experiments. It will be just a little bit more complicated. But you could do this kind of measurement, I think, in any situation where it could be a fractional quantum Hall state or something else, quasi-particles. But the SSH model is the simplest one to describe this. What is the SSH model? It's a very simple model of polyacetylene, where you have these dimerized bonds of strong and weak bonds. Okay, so it's a super simple lattice model. And if you, so there's a strong bond, a weak bond, a strong bond, a weak bond between these lattice sides. And if we think of realizing something this with our optical lattices, it's just something like this. Oops, I should make a weak bond, strong bond. So it's just array of double wells. Okay? Strong bond, weak bond, strong bond, weak bond. That's all we need. So what's the dispersion relation of this Schuster-Heger model? You basically have lower band, upper band. The band gap is determined by the difference in the tunneling matrix elements between the strong and weak bond. And now, where come fractional charges into play? If you cut this chain at the right point, so let me draw it again here a little bit longer. If you cut this chain here, if you put a wall here, put a wall here, and you put a wall here, it actually turns out there's not only the bulk properties given by this energy dispersion relation, but there are also zero energy edge states here, which corresponds to exponentially localized modes here at the edge. So these are states which are localized here at the edge. Okay. So now, let's fill this band. Let's go to a case where we have half filling. So we fill this lower band, which means in the bulk, we have one half particle per lattice site. Okay, in the bulk. But on the edge, it turns out on the edge what we have is precisely one particle localized to this edge mode. So now let's imagine what would happen if you take a snapshot, an atomic snapshot of such a configuration. What would you see? Well, what you would see here in the bulk would be a system with a lot of fluctuations. You could measure 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, something that on average has half a particle per site, okay, but with a lot of fluctuations. Whereas in the boundary, in this exponentially localized boundary here, you will always find precisely one particle, precisely one, without any fluctuations at all. So above the background density of 1 half, n bar 1 half, you have this one particle which has 1 half charge above the background density. That's the fractional charge we're talking about. Okay, and that's a way how to microscopically measure it. And the same ideas, I say, would apply to quasi-particles in the fractional quantum Hall effect. It's a little bit more complicated there. But that's the same way how you would see that actually in these quantum gas microscopes, and you could really directly see, you know, the fractional charges in the system.
Which quantity do you actually measure?
Well, I just measure atoms. I make a photo of atoms. I just measure photos of atoms, and atoms are not split, so they always appear as entire objects. So they have to always light up somewhere. Okay. What it means is, like, if this mode is very localized, to less than a lattice spacing, then what I was saying is true, then I will always find precisely one on this lattice side. Whereas here I will find something, you know, I can't predict with a lot of fluctuations.
In other words, you're measuring the magnitude squared of C?
Well, yes, of these underlying particle configurations, sure. But I can, you know, determine the average occupation. I can determine the fluctuations of the particle number occupation here from those measurements. Anything that has to do with density correlations, I can measure.
So at a given snapshot, you will have one particle between the two nearby wells, in other words. So there will be one.
Well, if this, okay, so this mode is local, it has a decay length psi, this edge mode. If psi is much shorter, let me discuss the case when it's shorter than a lattice spacing, then it's really such that the particle, this one, is really here.
Yeah, but you have to get the average background density.
Then I just repeated measurements. You know, in a single snapshot, I can get a totally random configuration here. Then I repeat the experiment, I get another random configuration. I repeat the experiment, I get another random configuration. And then I look at the fluctuations, for example, that I find on this lattice side versus the fluctuations I find here. In the bulk, you will find large fluctuations, whereas on the edge, you find zero fluctuations. Corresponding to that. And again, the same concept would apply if you have a quasi-particle in a fractional quantum Hall effect with a fractional charge. If you could pin that quasi-particle to a certain site, you would measure exactly the same thing with the quantum gas microscopes. It just gives an idea of what it means to have these fractional charges. Okay, so let me give you a little bit of an update where we stand with the quantum gas microscope, because what's interesting in the Fermi-Hubbard model is that you know, so you have fermions on a lattice, so you have tunneling of those fermions between lattice sites, and you have this simple interaction term, sigma n i sigma prime, in the system. So this is the Fermi-Hubbard model that we study on the lattice. And if you are at half filling, so you basically have half a particle per lattice site, so half a spin, half filling in the system, we know that the system first, as you cool down, forms a Mott insulator, where you have an incompressible Mott insulator. And as you cool further down, it actually forms an antiferromagnet, Heisenberg antiferromagnet. And you can show that by simply going to the strong interaction regime, where U is much larger than the kinetic energy in the system. You can transform this into a Heisenberg Hamiltonian precisely at this half filling point. And the ground state, of course, of the Heisenberg model for fermions is just the antiferromagnet in the system. Okay. Now, to do that, what you need in terms of entropy per particle, this is a much more meaningful quantity for the cold atom experiment, since we're not connected to any thermal reservoirs, is that the entropy per particle has to be smaller than log 2, because that's the maximum entropy you can carry in a spin chain. Okay, that was for a long time considered to be difficult, and now it has been reached that we can go, I think, clearly below log 2, and we can see a longer-range antiferromagnetic correlations in the system. Okay, actually, we can see correlations. I think Marcus holds the record right now in Harvard with up to 8 sites. All the 8 sites directly measured antiferromagnetic correlations in these systems. Okay, that for that to see that, you have to be clearly below this log 2 entropy. You have to be below this log entropy. Okay, so why is this interesting? Well, if you look at the cuprates phase diagram, and they typically show the following behavior, and we believe that the Fermi-Hubbard model actually is foundational in describing this phase diagram. So here we have temperature, here we have the hole doping. If we're precisely at half filling, I told you we have an antiferromagnet. This is this Heisenberg antiferromagnet. And then we have, as we increase the doping, we have this V-wave superconducting door. And also a lot of stuff actually which is happening at higher temperatures is super interesting and not well understood. So now, actually, what we want to do, we would like to go away from this antiferromagnetic point. We would like to introduce holes into the system, because all of this interesting regime is actually where there's an interplay between these hole degrees of freedom, these charge degrees of freedom, and magnetism. That's where the unsolved problem in the Fermi-Hubbard model lies. Okay, here, pretty much at the half-filling point, everything is quite well understood. But once you go away and introduce holes into the system, things are very, very poorly understood. And even though there's been kind of intense work on that.
So have you actually seen the antiferromagnetic order?
Yeah.
Or are you only seeing correlations?
Well, I mean, I would say that's the same thing. No, I mean, what I'm measuring is spin correlations over different distances. So I have one site, two sites, three sites, four sites, and I can see kind of, in our case, because we're thermal, we looked at it in 1D, you have exponentially decaying correlations. T equals 0 would be power law decaying correlations, and you can measure those directly.
So if you have exponentially decaying correlations, your correlation length is short. That's
right. I should say, even the power law, something, I mean, I wasn't so aware of, even in 1D, you have the power law decay is quite strong too, actually.
Right.
So this picture of long one up, down is pretty poor, actually, in one dimension. The correlations don't extend over very long distances, even in the ground state, even at T equals 0.
So are you seeing power law correlations?
No, we see because we're at finite temperature, we always see kind of exponentially decaying correlations.
I see. So you're actually, in that phase diagram, above the antiferromagnetic order then?
No, we see antiferromagnetic order, but if you're at finite temperature, you will have exponentially decaying correlations. We're below this entropy of, temperature would be below exchange temperature.
Uh-huh.
Entropy-wise, this is below this log 2 entropy that we see.
What's the correlation length?
So it's about 2 to 3 sites.
Okay.
The thermal decay length, so the exponential decay that we measure. And we can follow that up to 4 to 5 sites then. You know, then the correlations just become too small for us to measure. But let me give you, I think, an interesting twist. What we can do now with these quantum gas microscopes is that we can basically measure the full configuration of particles on a lattice without the problem of what some of you might be aware of, this nasty parity projection. So far in the quantum gas microscopes, a problem has been that we've really not been faithfully measuring the density of the particles on the lattice, but if you look at these atoms in a lattice, in these optical lattices, whenever you had 2 of them in the lattice, or for bosons, 3, pairwise atoms would always get lost when we started illuminating the system. So from an occupation like this, what I would have measured in my experiment would be something like one particle, no particles, one particle. So we call this the parity. Okay, so it's just the original occupation modulo 2. And that's, of course, a severe limitation. And we don't want that. So how do we get around that? How we get around that is the following way. So let me draw in a one-dimensional situation for a Fermi-Hubbard chain how it could look like. The same ideas apply to 2D systems. So we could have a spin up, a down, a hole. Could have a double on, so a site which is occupied by a spin up and a spin down particle. Spin down, spin up, so forth. And we want to measure that faithfully. To do that, what we can do is we can actually split this single line into two lines under the action of a magnetic field gradient. So basically making a controlled Stangella separation, which separates this chain into two chains. And the spin-up particles will go into the upper half, the spin-down particles will go into the lower part, and then we illuminate and detect. So everything that's up here is spin-up particles. So we see then here, up, hole, hole, up, hole, up. And in the lower chain, we would see hole, a particle there, a particle here, spin-down, hole, spin-down, spin-down. So I call this, it's like, for those of you who know interline CCD cameras, it's basically something like that. Okay. So we split the two spin components, then we take an image, and of course by summing those, I can faithfully reconstruct what I originally had. Okay. And that allows me to fully measure the full kind of distribution of spins, holes, and doublons in the system. So now we can start to ask interesting questions. So now I can, for example, start to ask, if there is a hole, if let's say we have an antiform magnet, and let me just picture it like this classical nail antiform magnet, even though we know the Heisenberg state is something much more complicated. If we remove a single particle from this hole, if we introduce a hole here, and if I just do it like this, then you would think there are ferromagnetic correlations around this hole. But that's actually not true. The ground state of a hole, if you introduce a hole into the system, it's actually a domain wall. So actually, the ground state configuration that we expect to have around holes is actually an antiferromagnetic order. So it's like your antiferromagnet has been shifted by one lattice size. And to measure that, what you have to measure is basically the correlation function of the spin. Let's say you have sites I, J, and K. So you measure the spin on site I correlated with having a hole on site J correlated with the spin on site K. Okay? That's what you want to measure. And that's indeed what we can measure. And we have indeed first measurement data which showed that you indeed have this antiferromagnetic order around the holes. And now you can go even one step further. You could go now to 2D systems where this is much less clear. In 1D, it's very clear, calculations are known. In 2D, it's not so clear. And also, you could have two holes that you put next to each other and ask, what do two holes do? Do they start to attract each other because of their deformation of the antiferromagnetic background? Is there a binding between those holes? What do these correlation functions look like? So now we're really starting to address questions, I think, which are computationally hard and which have real relevance to this. All right. I think I'm not going to make it to topic 3. I talked about an hour and should never talk more than an hour. So I think I'll just leave it here. For those of you, just maybe also mention, this is, of course, also the scenario of spin-hole separation, spin-charge separation. This hole can actually freely move through the spin chain, whereas in 2D it could not, because it would have to deform the antiferromagnetic background so strongly that it stays confined to its original position. That's something you can also look at now. You know, you can introduce this hole, see how it propagates freely in 1D, but as soon as you couple different layers together, you see how it gets frozen, how it gets more and more stuck. All right, so we didn't make it to many body localization, but I hope nevertheless I showed you some two interesting things that we're working on right now that have been very much inspired, of course, by longstanding, you know, work in condensed matter physics, and of course this year's Nobel Prize. So thanks a lot.
So you say you can measure the full distribution function.
Yes.
You measure moments of them, or? I mean, what do you
yeah, mean? So we get a certain, so when we measure, we are asserting certain configuration of those particles arises. Yeah? And I can just measure the probability with which that arises. So I can not only measure the average value of this, I can measure the fluctuation around that. I get the full distribution function of that correlator. Of course, well, the higher the correlator, the more data I have to take, so it gets complicated. But for the string order, we showed that we could measure up to 8-point correlators, so to show kind of string correlations.
You have to prepare the same state each time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Can you talk about what the breakthrough was to get better cooling on the Fermi optical ladder systems? I always thought this was a real difficult problem, but it seems like this.
Yeah, I think basically lithium is very favorable. I think the fact that we're looking at single systems has really helped, that we're not averaging over 3D clouds. So it seems that in the center of these clouds, actually, the temperature is lower than you when you just average over the whole system. Also, I think what Marx is using is a nice trick of entropy shaping. So you can basically, the idea is, you know, you have a system where the entropy is like homogeneously distributed in the overall. But if you could basically do it in such a way, modify the system in such a way that more entropy is located at the boundaries, then you would have a core system which carries less entropy. And by clever trap shaping, you can do that. Okay, so basically making a dimple trap, a reservoir, which looks something like this, you store a lot of kind of configurational entropy in the positions on the particles in the wings of the cloud, whereas the center part can have very low entropy. And then, of course, corresponding to lower temperature. And then you can see these longer range correlations. Yeah, I think this is just starting. So I think there's way, we haven't really started even optimizing this. This is just the first experiments happening over the last 2 months, 2 or 3 months. So I think it's promising, no? For many years, we said we could do this, and we never really made strong progress. I think now there's real progress on this front.
And the charge spin separation you see, you also get anomalous charge and spin, right? You get neutral spin.
Okay, that you have to tell me about. I mean, the only thing I know, I mean, in this degree, basically, you have the spin-on and the holons. Holon can just propagate in this configuration freely, and it relieves behind the spin, excitation, which propagates in the other direction. So that I have to talk about that.
Luke, are you in this setup also able to measure dynamical correlation function?
Yeah, that's a tricky question. I think it's slightly incompatible with the strong measurement we're doing here, right? I mean, when we measure, the system is collapsed. I mean, the way it's not the original psi that we have anymore. So what we typically, to measure dynamical correlations, we do the following. So I prepare my psi. I, for example, at some position at time t equals 0, I flip a spin deterministically, but only at that local position. And then I let the system evolve. And then I do the strong measurement at a later time t. Okay, that's how we can get kind of spin-spin correlation functions by doing things like that.
Can you measure also superconducting tendencies in that region?
Oh yeah, you can measure transport properties, you can measure vortices. I mean, we didn't do that, but I think if you look at Debbie Jin's work and Sanketa, the people who did DCS-BC crossover physics, the way how they probe for superconductivity is, for example, trying to induce vortices in the system or basically look at transport properties or the frictionless, when you drag, let's say, a barrier through the system so that it can be without friction, without generating any heat, up to some critical velocity, for example.
So you might be able to combine this kind of magnetism and...
Yeah, that would be nice, yeah. Yeah. And I also want to stress, what's also, I think, exciting, this possibility to measure local currents. Local current operators, really at the level of single bonds. I think that's a super interesting possibility. I haven't really thought about that, but maybe just to give you some idea.
Do you actually measure phase or measuring, are you?
Yeah, so what we do, how we do it is the following. If you want to measure current operators, let's say, so these are the physical lattice sites. Now you want to measure the current up between those two bonds. So what we actually do, we disconnect all the other bonds. We turn this into a double well. We make the particles non-interacting via Feshbach resonance, and then we just look at the Josephson oscillations in this double well. And the phase of the Josephson oscillations in the double well tells us what the original current was on that bond. We do that in parallel on all the bonds. So that's how we do that.
Okay. Thank you so much.